welcome to the November edition of The Astropod. I'm Quinton Goddard.
And I'm Anna Quiter.
Well, listeners, we're bringing you another fruit bowl laden full of astronomy goodness this month.
I actually don't know what that means. But
It's a good thing.
Anyways, I hope that all of you were able to make it out on Wednesday to hear my talk.
I hear it was a rousing success, Anna.
Yeah, 100 people, even though it was raining.
That's always a good turnout. In fact, I think almost every week we have a pretty good turnout for the public evenings here.
Yeah, we do, but we always have room for more. So I encourage you all to come out. Wednesdays at 7 o'clock, we have a lecture at 7:15, and then afterwards there's observing with our historical telescopes.
It's always a good night out. And that reminds me, Anna, the Institute of Astronomy is calling all Cubs, Scouts, Girl Guides, and Brownies to come here so they can try and get their astronomy and stargazing badges.
However, you shouldn't just show up. Instead, you should go to our website, www.ast.cam.ac.uk, and click the public link. That will let you contact Dr. Carolyn Crawford, who's our outreach coordinator, and you should book your group with her.
Well, I think it'll be a great evening here at the Institute of Astronomy. And you get another badge as well at the end of it. Not from us, obviously, but from your Scout or Girl Guide organization. We don't deal with badges, but we just do the telescope bit.
Right.
Sorry, too much information. So let's move on, Anna. I hear that NASA have been launching another rocket.
Yes, the Ares rocket, which is part of the Constellation program, just launched on Wednesday.
So why are they launching new rockets, Anna?
Well, Quincy, they're launching new rockets as part of their new space exploration program, where we're going to try and go to Mars or the Moon.
I hear that President Obama was thinking about refunding this or saying there was too much money going into this project, though.
Well, we're hoping that NASA comes through and that Congress and the Obama administration will continue to fund space exploration.
But is it really worth trying to, you know, actually get men into space when robots could probably do a much better job? And, you know, if we do lose robots, then it's not a big deal.
Yeah, the argument I've heard on this front is that human exploration is part of our nature. And we're sort of going out into the unknown and sending people and sort of pushing the boundaries of what humanity can do. And also, NASA has a big engineering mandate. So a lot of what they do is to design new technology and that sort of thing, rather than to just push scientific frontiers.
Well, I think this is a very interesting debate, Anna, and one which we could get, well, really stuck into. But let's try and move on with the Astropod. What have we got coming up this month?
Well, this month, we have The Sky at Night with Alex, we have The News with Laura, we have my fabulous histories feature, we have the interview.
That's right, Anna, and this month I'm speaking to Mike Irwin about the Andromeda Galaxy. All very exciting stuff. But now let's go over to Laura for some astronomy news.
Hi, I'm Laura, and welcome to this month's Astro News. Saturn's largest ring. The planet Saturn is famous for its glittering rings, but a new Nature paper indicates that the Saturnian ring system may be even more spectacular than previously thought. Astronomers from the University of Virginia used NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope to study the dust around Saturn in the mid-infrared. This allows them to spot the dust as it re-radiates light absorbed from the Sun as heat that Spitzer can detect. They found a very tenuous ring extending for 12 million kilometers from Saturn's outermost moon, Phoebe, which orbits at around 6 million kilometers from Saturn. So why hadn't anyone spotted this giant ring earlier? Well, this ring contains less dust than the previously discovered rings around Saturn, and it covers a much larger area, making it much harder to observe. Anne Verbisker, one of the authors of the paper, said that there are only 10 to 20 particles in a cubic kilometer of space. If you were standing in the ring, you wouldn't even notice it. This ring may well help solve another mystery about Saturn. One of Saturn's moons, Iapetus, is highly unusual in that one side of the moon is much more reflective or has a higher albedo than the other. This means that one hemisphere appears white while the other is very dark. When scientists analysed the composition of the dust on the dark side of Iapetus, they found it very similar to the surface of another of Saturn's moons, Phoebe. The new gossamer ring around Saturn shares many characteristics with Phoebe's orbit, and so it's thought to be composed of dust from Phoebe, liberated when meteorites collide with the moon. When Iapetus's orbit crosses this dust ring, dark dust particles stick to the leading face of the moon, causing the surface on Iapetus to become darker. HARP's new Hall of Exoplanets. On the Astro News, we often tell you about new discoveries of extrasolar planets, but this month there were 32 new exoplanets announced. These new planets were found by the HARPS team. HARPS is a radio velocity spectrograph on the 3.6 meter telescope at the European Southern Observatory in La Silla, Chile. It's been taking data since 2003. HARPS uses radial velocity, which is a method for detecting exoplanets that involves monitoring the parent star for a wobble caused by the pull of the planet's gravity. ARPS has now discovered over 75 planets, including 24 of the 28 planets known to have masses below 20 times that of the Earth. They haven't got any planets the same mass of Earth in this new bunch, but there are a few around the mass of Neptune, so tens of Earth masses. These are called super-Earths. My favourite of the new discoveries is a planet with 6 times the mass of the Earth around a star called Gliese 667c. It orbits at a distance of only 1/20th the distance of the Earth from the Sun, and Gliese 667c is an M star, making it less than half the mass of the Sun. It's also part of a hierarchical triple system, where the star orbits a close pair of binary stars at a distance of around 200 astronomical units. More observations of the most distant known object in the universe. On April 23, 2009, the SWIFT satellite detected a gamma-ray burst, and scientists soon realised that it was more than 13 billion light-years away from Earth, making it the most distant known object. In the hours after the burst, some of the world's largest telescopes, including the Very Large Array Radio Telescope, were trained on the burst. Astronomers have now finished analysing this data, and have found that despite its great distance, the burst itself turned out to be fairly normal for a GRB. But it did indicate that the massive stars that are thought to be the progenitors of gamma-ray bursts existed this early in the universe. The existence of massive stars more than 13 billion years ago has long been suspected, but this is the first direct observational proof. That's all for this month's Astro News.
Thanks, Laura, for that fantastic news section. It's quite interesting, Anna, to hear that we've got so many exoplanets being found. How are we ever going to keep track of all of these things?
Well, Quincy, the current naming system is based around the star that the planets are going around. So the planets have the star name first, plus the letters B, C, D, E, signifying which order the planets are found in.
But this result in really long, ugly names? I mean, it's pretty hard for me to remember planets with just sort of alphanumeric names, Anna.
Well, you're not alone, Quincy. So it turns out that Dr. Lyra at the Max Planck Institute has actually proposed a new naming scheme for extrasolar planets. This scheme is based around Greek mythological characters. So what they do is they take the planet that's around a star in a constellation, and they name that planet for a Greek mythological character who's associated with the myth for the constellation in which the planet is found.
You know what, Anna? I think that sort of makes sense. Give me an example.
So an example would be in the constellation Bootes, there is a star named HD128311, and there is a planet around that star, so the planet's current name is HD128311b. Under the new naming system, that planet will just be named Bacchus. And the reason that planet is named Bacchus is because Bootes was a grape grower, and he invited the god Bacchus over to inspect his vineyard.
Bacchus was the Roman god of wine and partying, wasn't he?
I bet he's your favorite, isn't he?
He is, Anna. He certainly is. Well, it sounds like a really good naming system, but aren't we going to run out of names or run out of Greek gods for, you know, the 400 plus planets we now have?
I think that that's true, and that you've just pointed out one of the weaknesses of this sort of system.
Well, I think if we keep on naming planets like this, Anna, we might have to branch out into Norse mythology and other gods.
Yeah, it's possible.
Well, it should make for some very interesting planet names. I think we're going to move on to the history feature now, Anna. What have you got for us?
Well, coincidentally, we're staying on the subject of myths. This month I'll be talking about the myth of Andromeda. So as you know, Andromeda is a well-known constellation, as well as the name of our largest nearby spiral galaxy. For thousands of years, people have found a connection between themselves and the sky. For the ancient Greeks, the sky was a place where they saw their myths played out by the sun, moon, and other celestial bodies. The characters in their myths are often represented by the constellations. The famous Greek astronomer Ptolemy recorded the constellation Andromeda in his seminal work, the Almagest, in the 2nd century AD, although this constellation was probably around long before he wrote it down. This brings us to the story behind the constellation Andromeda, which can be found in the northern sky under the famous W-shaped constellation Cassiopeia. Andromeda was a beautiful Ethiopian princess, daughter of King Cepheus and Queen Cassiopeia. Cassiopeia bragged that she was more beautiful than Juno, queen of the gods, as well as the Nereids, who were sea nymphs. This insult to the nymphs enraged Poseidon, the god of the sea, so he sent a sea monster to ravage the Ethiopian coast. Some accounts say that this sea monster was Cetus. After consulting the oracle of Zeus, king of the gods, it was revealed that the only way to stop the sea monster was to appease Poseidon by sacrificing Andromeda to the sea monster. Therefore, Andromeda was chained to a rock on the coast to await her consumption by the monster. It just so happens that Perseus was flying by on his return journey from killing Medusa when he saw Andromeda sorrowfully chained to the rock. He instantly fell in love with her and went to speak with her. At that moment, the monster emerged from the sea, intent upon consuming Andromeda. Perseus went to Andromeda's nearby and quite distressed parents, telling them that he will defeat the monster and save Andromeda if they promise him Andromeda's hand in marriage. They agreed, so Perseus kills the monster, rescues Andromeda, and they wed. As you may have noticed, several characters in this myth are also represented in the night sky. Constellations are named for Cassiopeia, Cepheus, Cetus, and Perseus. The Latin names for Zeus and Poseidon are Jupiter and Neptune, and they are represented in the night sky by the planets bearing their name. Now here's Quincy talking to Mike about the Andromeda Galaxy.
Hello and welcome to the Astropod interview. This month I'm interviewing Mike Irwin. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks and hello.
So Mike, you've recently been part of a group that's published a paper in the journal Nature, very sort of high level general journal, all about sort of Andromeda and its interaction with M33. So I thought today we'd try and get to grips with Andromeda and why it's important to study this very nearby spiral galaxy. So let's start just by telling us a little bit about the Andromeda Galaxy.
Okay, well, I'm going to start a little bit further away, actually. I'm going to start with the Milky Way first, because the things we try and do in astronomy is study nearby objects, because you can see a lot more detail about what's going on. And one of the problems with studying our own galaxy is that you're sitting in the middle of the plane of the galaxy, and it's quite difficult to see all aspects of our own galaxy. In contrast, the Andromeda Galaxy, or M31, is our next nearest neighbour, and it's extremely easy to survey the whole of it with a relatively small amount of telescope time. So we're interested in studying it because we think it's essentially a twin sister galaxy of the Milky Way. And by studying it from an external viewpoint, you get a completely different angle on what is going on.
It is quite interesting just how similar our galaxy appears to be with Andromeda. But Andromeda is, you know, it's the sort of brightest object we can see with the naked eye in the night sky, which is nice. But surely it's been sort of almost overstudied now by astronomers because it's so bright and close to us.
Well, I think the interesting thing about the Andromeda Galaxy is if you look at it on photographic sky survey plates, which until relatively recently was the best way of looking at the large scale structure, what you see is a beautiful classical spiral disk with dust lanes visible and so on. What you don't see is all the faint lower brightness features that we now expect to find in galaxies like that.
So you've been involved in a panoramic survey of Andromeda. What exactly have you guys been finding?
Well, first of all, the name of this panoramic survey, its nickname is PANDAS. And it stands for Pan Andromeda Archaeological Survey. And what we use is a telescope on Hawaii to look very deeply against the night sky, so that you're always limited by the night sky in astronomy. Although, even on dark sites on mountaintops, the brightness of the night sky prevents you easily finding low-level detail. So what we've been doing is a large area survey to try and map essentially faint traces of the galaxy formation process.
So you're looking for the sort of remnants of interactions between these galaxies when they had formed. How do you actually go about doing that? What kind of stars are you looking for in the survey?
Well, you go about doing it by taking essentially roughly 1 hour integrations on as large a telescope as you can get your hands on with a reasonably large field of view. So the field of view of this particular telescope, called the CFH, the Canada-French-Hawaii telescope, is about 1 degree on the sky. And nowadays, there are very sensitive electronic detectors, CCDs, that you can use to tile the area of 1 square degree on a telescope like that. And what you do is you, by essentially taking advantage of modern technology, you can go much fainter. And if you go faint enough, you can start picking up the brightest giant stars in M31 and its neighboring satellites. And by essentially mapping the distribution of these giant stars, you can actually trace the structures around M31 that you can't normally see.
So this is very, very faint structure that I would never be able to pick up with my telescope sitting at home, even if I, you know, watch for the whole evening.
Well, that's certainly true. It's something like 10,000 times fainter than the night sky itself. If you sort of integrated the overall brightness of the structures we're finding, it's at least 10,000 times fainter than the night sky. So it makes it extremely difficult to find with a normal sort of photographic technique. But if you can resolve individual stars, you can essentially count them as a function of position on the sky.
So you're actually resolving individual red giant brunch stars, the stars near the end of their life.
Yes, we resolve individual stars. And the nice thing about red giant brunch stars is they last a significant amount of time, and they also exist for anywhere between a billion years ago and 10 billion years ago. They take a long time to expire from their birth. So you actually get a very good tracer of the overall sort of properties of the galaxy just by measuring the properties of these stars.
So it's almost like a log of the galaxy's interactions throughout its lifetime is contained within this sort of distribution of red giant branch stars.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, you can even go one further than that, because the colour of these red giant branch stars is actually an indication of their formation process. In other words, how much metals have gone into forming the stars that you're actually now measuring, you can actually measure by purely looking at the colour of the stars. And by doing that, you can partition the sort of giant branch stars you're seeing into metal-rich, metal-poor, and average metallisty, say, and thereby get a significantly more insight, actually, into what you're looking at when you're looking at these giant branch stars around M31.
So you're actually sort of deconstructing the sort of image that you've got on the sky into various different interactions.
Yeah, indeed, that's what we're doing. And in fact, what you can do is you can actually make sort of false colour images of the distribution of the stars by splitting it into sort of red, green and blue channels according to how metal-rich these objects are, how metal-poor. And by doing that, what we generally find is that satellite galaxies that are still intact around objects like M31 are relatively metal-poor. So if you make a sort of colour image or a pseudo-colour image, they show up as blue objects. And you can trace those quite easily, even in spite of the fact there's a lot of other objects that have similar colours.
Now, the PANDAS survey revealed a lot of structure around not just Andromeda, but around its sort of nearest dwarf neighbour, M33. Can you tell us a little bit about this interaction?
Well, M33 is not quite a dwarf. I mean, it's about one-tenth of the luminosity of M31, and it's about probably around a tenth of the mass of M31. So it's a fairly significant spiral galaxy in its own right. It's somewhat different in appearance on the sky. But the one thing that we know about M33 is that it has a very large amount of hydrogen gas in it, and the hydrogen gas is actually warped. So instead of a flat disk of a spiral galaxy, what you see is a strange sort of warped disk. And until recently, we didn't really know if the stars in the galaxy did the same sort of thing. So what we've now seen is evidence for this same signature, i.e. a warp, in the star distribution. And furthermore, we now know from our recent observations that the stars are streaming out the ends of this disk. And very significantly, the warp in the stars looks very similar to the warp in the gas. And the simplest way to get features like that is for strong tidal interactions between, in this case, M33 and M31.
So you've actually made this fantastic-looking movie of the interaction between M33 and Andromeda. And it appears that they almost don't touch, but it still disrupts M33 quite a lot.
It's a very sensitive measure. I mean, it wasn't me who made it. It was some colleagues in Canada. But the nice thing about the movie is it demonstrates that the features you see in M33 are constrain the relative motions of M33 and M31. In other words, if M33 gets too close to M31, it gets more or less completely disrupted. If it gets too far away, nothing much happens. And there's a very small range of distances over which a signature of a warp in the stars and the gas is viable. And although, as you say, it doesn't get that close, the gravitational attraction of M31 is significant even at that large distances. And it's this gravitational tidal field that really introduces all these strange signatures you see in the star distribution.
So this is really a fantastic example of galaxies interacting and disrupting one another.
Well, it's exactly what we expect to see as well. I mean, cosmology predicts that things like this happen all the time. Surprisingly, until only 15 years ago, we had no real direct evidence of this in our own neighbourhood. So around the Milky Way and around M31, we had no idea that this sort of process was going on, even though our cosmological colleagues were saying that this ought to be happening all the time, because essentially gravity is the dominant force, and it causes things to interact.
So with the galaxies colliding into one another, what actually happens to the individual stars in each of those galaxies?
Well, the gaps between the stars in a typical galaxy, even in the crowded bits, are huge. So when they collide, they don't actually collide like billiard balls. They just interact with each other, a bit like the Earth and the Moon orbiting the Sun. If you imagine, the gaps between them are quite large in the planetary system. So if you collided two planetary systems together, you wouldn't actually collide the individual objects, you just disturb their orbits. And that's essentially what happens when galaxies collide.
So the stars remain intact, but the sort of structure of the galaxy is the bit that's disrupted and distorted.
The beautiful spiral patterns change, and any gas and dust gets redistributed in a different way. And essentially, you end up with a complete mess if you have two big galaxies colliding with each other.
So is Andromeda going to interact with our galaxy at any point in the future?
Well, we're in the process of trying to measure whether this is going to happen in the near future. And the way you do that is you look at how fast Andromeda is approaching us. And we've known this for a long time now. It's actually 120 kilometers a second, which is pretty fast. But on the other hand, it's such far distance away, it's going to take several billion years to get here. What we don't know is its transverse motion, i.e. its motion across the sky relative to us. So if it had a large transverse motion, then it wouldn't collide with us significantly. If it's a very small transverse motion, i.e. it's more or less coming straight at us, then you would expect a significant collision. And the current best measurements of that motion suggest that it will be more or less directly at us. And in a few billion years' time, there will be a significant interaction between our two galaxies. And of course, the end result of that, we think, would be something like a large elliptical galaxy eventually.
Should be a fantastic collision when it does happen, but I'm not sure we'll be around to see it.
Well, unless you plan to live for a few billion years, no, that's probably true.
Well, Mike, thanks for coming onto the show and chatting to us about Andromeda and all the fascinating things that you've been discovering.
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me.
Cheers.
Thanks, Quincy and Mike. Now here's Alex with the sky at night.
Up in the skies this month. This month's meteor shower is the Leonid meteor shower, seeming to come from the constellation Leo in the east, and peaking in intensity on November 17th. The comet 55P Temple-Tuttle is responsible for it, and traditionally the shower is a fairly weak display with only about 10 meteors an hour, however this year may be a little bit more special. Every time a comet passes close to the sun, some of the surface gets hot, evaporating the ice there and spewing out dense clumps of dust. This year, the Earth will pass through the trails left by the comet in 1102, 1466, and 1533, and so there should be very short bursts of activity associated with each clump. Meteor specialists predict that the peak of activity should be between 9:30 to 10 o'clock on November the 17th, with up to hundreds of meteors an hour for a couple of hours, and so if you have very clear skies, it should be a spectacular show. At the very beginning of this month, the star Arcturus, in the west-northwest at twilight, took up its role as the ghost of summer suns. This means that it's where the sun would have been if it was that time in June or July, and so it is like a ghost of that summer sun. Very relevant for Halloween. Orion is creeping back into our skies during this month, and if you stay up past 10 p.m, then you'll start to see his arms low in the east. Above Orion is the bright orange star Aldebaran, considered to be the eye in the bull of Taurus, and above that is the most obvious star cluster to the naked eye, the Pleiades. Venus is now only visible at dawn and is getting closer and closer to the horizon, although it is sufficiently bright that it should be easy to spot. In contrast, Saturn is getting higher and higher in the sky as the month goes on, and can be found above and to the right of Venus in the east-southeast during early dawn. After dusk, Jupiter is bright and easily spotted in the south, before setting after midnight, and if you have a small telescope, then you might be able to spot Neptune, 6 degrees to the east of Jupiter. Similarly, if you like challenges, then Uranus is high in the sky in the southeast after dark. Finally, whilst it may be winter here, it's now spring in the northern hemisphere of Mars. Currently in the constellation Cancer, it rises as Jupiter sets at around midnight and is best viewed before dawn, when it's very high in the southeast, below Gemini's head stars, Castor and Pollux. And that's it for the sky at night this month. Now back to Quentin and Anna.
Thanks, Alex.
Beep, 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 beep.
What are you doing?
Beep, beep. Well, I was trying to be the Mars Phoenix lander, Anna.
Oh, okay. Why?
Well, didn't you hear, Alex? He was talking about it's actually sort of springtime in the northern hemisphere on Mars.
Oh, what does that have to do with the Phoenix lander?
Well, it's been deactivated for the whole winter, sitting on the surface of Mars, and now that it's getting to springtime, it's getting warmer, there's more sunlight, and there's actually a small chance that it might actually reactivate and start sending signals back to Earth.
Oh, do they think it's really likely that that'll happen?
Well, we're hoping, but they're not quite sure. We'll have to wait and see for Martian summer to really start, so a few more months yet.
I look forward to that in the Astronews, then.
More exciting times, Anna. Well now, listeners, we might have forgotten to mention that we do once again have the Astronomy Joke of the Month. And here it is with Michelle.
Hey, Anna.
Hey, Michelle.
Are you ready for another awesome joke of the month?
Hit me with it.
Okay. What kind of baseball games do they play in space?
I don't know. What kind do they play?
All-star games.
Oh, God.
Well, for any listeners still listening to the show after that horrific joke, it's time for us to say goodbye. Thanks for tuning in.
See you next month.